Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 5th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk astronomy with Dr. Valerie Rapson of SUNY Oneonta. We have possibly a solution to the mystery of those fast radio bursts. We'll talk about that. A NASA spacecraft 200 million miles away has put 2 pounds of asteroid samples into a capsule and it's heading back to Earth. Also, they may have discovered water on the sunlit portions of the moon. Oh yeah, and there's a beautiful meteor shower which will be peaking in the next week or so. We'll talk about all of that with Valerie Rapson. If you have an astronomy question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson and your astronomy calls coming up after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk astronomy with Dr. Valerie Rapson, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. Dr. Rapson earned her PhD in astrophysical sciences and technology from RIT. Her research focused on the structure and composition of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. Dr. Rapson spent 5 years developing and teaching astronomy education programs for the Dudley Observatory and is now an assistant professor in the Physics and Astronomy Department at SUNY Oneonta. If you have an astronomy question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Ray. Great to be here.
How are things where you are? And you guys are all remote this semester, right?
Yeah, we switched to remote pretty early in the semester, but things are going good. We only have a couple of weeks left, and the students have been doing a great job handling the online classes. All of my students are doing well, so I'm a happy professor.
That is good news. Well, there was some news about magnetars, I suppose. Suppose we will start with that, and then you can tell me what a magnetar is. But we've had this issue that they have been looking at now for a couple of decades, I guess, where there are these fast radio bursts. And at first, they seem to come from very, very far away, galaxies so far away. Mm-hmm. And in a bit of luck, they may have solved this mystery. They found one that came from within our galaxy. Maybe you can tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, sure. So I know we've talked about these fast radio bursts before, and what they basically are flashes of light at the radio wavelengths that happen very quickly. We're talking like millisecond flashes of light, but they're incredibly bright, and they seem to be coming from very distant galaxies. But recently, astronomers actually captured one of these fast radio bursts from what appears to be a magnetar inside of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
So these magnetars, these are basically the cores of dead stars that are really massive. You have a huge star that goes supernova, and what's left over is this incredibly dense core of neutrons with some protons and electrons mixed in near the surface, and it can become highly magnetized. So we call it a magnetar. It has a huge magnetic field. It can be a trillion times stronger of a field than what Earth has. So these magnetars, we recently captured one where we saw X-ray light, gamma ray light, and a fast radio burst come from this star pretty much all within the same couple of days. And it suggests that these fast radio bursts might actually be coming from the magnetars. We've never actually seen this happen before. We've never actually linked the fast radio burst to the magnetar. So this is the first time we've actually been able to put the two together.
What does it tell you about the nature of magnetars, the fact that these radio bursts are apparently coming from them?
Yeah, so we think they actually don't come directly from the star, but actually a wind that blows off the star. And what happens is you've got this really fast wind that blows away from the magnetar, and it collides with other material and wind that it passed away at an earlier time. And when that collision happens, you get charged particles that start to spiral around, and that's what actually creates the radiation that we see at the radio wavelength. So we get the flashes of light from the wind and the original collision, and then this results in fast radio bursts. So it tells us that these stars are not only spinning with really strong magnetic fields, but they also have these likely strong winds are being blown into space as well.
Do we know why some stars, as they die or collapse or whatever, develop these really strong magnetic fields? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, well, it all has to do with mass. We can only get these types of pulsars, neutron stars, magnetars. Those are all kind of roughly synonyms in the astronomy world. You have to have a massive star that collapses down to create one of these. And the more massive the star, the stronger the magnetic field it generally starts with. And then it just holds on to that field because it's rooted in the core. Once the star goes supernova, you still have the core left over with that strong magnetic field. But exactly, you know, how and why this works is still somewhat of a mystery. We know these objects have to spin very quickly. We know they have to have charged particles to contain this magnetic field. But the exact details are still something astronomers are trying to figure out.
You sent me a link from NASA.gov. NASA's SOFIA discovers water on the sunlit surface of the moon, and this was only from the past week or two. Fascinating news there. Before you tell us why it's fascinating, what is SOFIA?
Yeah, so SOFIA is actually a Boeing 747 aircraft that has a 106-inch telescope on the back end of it. And I actually had the opportunity to fly on this thing, about 5 years ago now. It was a really great experience. You actually go inside of the airplane, and you're in a normal pressurized portion of the airplane when you fly, but the telescope in the back actually has a really fancy garage door, we'll call it, that lifts up and exposes the telescope to the sky, and you fly at about 45,000 feet, and you can observe the sky in infrared at that height because you're above most of the water vapor and all of the material that would absorb the infrared radiation. So it's a way of building an infrared telescope.
Now, this is interesting. When they open this so-called garage door, are you wearing a pressure suit?
No, you don't have to, because all of it is behind a pressure bulkhead. So the telescope is completely isolated from the rest of the aircraft.
Yeah.
So you don't really feel anything different. But the telescope is specially designed to absorb the vibrations that you naturally get from the airplanes and the atmosphere and be able to operate at these high altitudes.
Very cool. I also saw this that came over a few days ago. And by the way, we're talking to Dr. Valerie Rapson today. It's astronomy. If you want to call in, we'll get to your calls after we take a short break in a moment. 800-348-2551. We talked the last time you were on about OSIRIS-REx and the mission to go to asteroid Bennu and pick up some stuff and bring it back. And at the time,
yeah.
I think that was it the day after and we still weren't sure? Or maybe it was the day of and we still weren't sure if they had gotten any of the stuff. But they have they have gotten stuff, about 2 pounds of asteroid samples, and they're now sending it back our way.
Yeah, exactly. So we had talked last time when they were just about to take this sample, and they actually did take the sample just a couple of weeks ago, and everything was successful. So the spacecraft basically has this arm that can gather up just a small amount, a couple pounds of material, if that, and it just quickly touches down on the surface. It shoots out some nitrogen gas, which kicks up a bunch of particles, and they get captured inside of this container that's ultimately going to be returned back to Earth. So everything went well a couple of days ago. The only hiccup that they had is when they tried to close the capsule right after the capture, the cover actually got a little bit stuck because some of the particles, they gathered so much material,
yeah,
they actually couldn't close the lid of the container all the way.
So they lost some.
But they didn't lose a whole lot. Yeah, they lost some, but not a ton, thankfully. And they actually expedited the storage of the container.
Yeah.
So now it's tucked away inside the spacecraft, and they're not going to lose any more material, thankfully. But everything went really smoothly aside from that.
Terrific. Now, to backtrack, because I've lost my train of thought, the water, we talked about SOFIA, but the water on the moon, why is that significant, and why doesn't it just evaporate into space?
Yeah, we got to get back to the water. So water on the moon is not a brand new discovery. We've known about water on the moon for quite a while.
In the bottom of craters.
That's the difference, is we've only really seen it like in the southern hemisphere in the craters where it's permanently in shadow, so it's always cold.
Yeah.
So you can have some frozen water in the soil. But now we've discovered it, again, in the southern hemisphere, but in a spot where it's actually frequently sunlit. Because the moon rotates rotates, it gets illuminated, and theoretically, the temperatures are high enough for the water to become liquid at some point. So they've discovered that, and it's just a small amount. It's basically the equivalent of like a bottle of water sprinkled over about a cubic meter of space, they say. So it's not a lot of water, but it's definitely there for sure.
And what does that tell you? I mean, first of all, I assume that this was deposited at some point by a comet or something. But does that mean that given there is the possibility of liquid water on the moon, even briefly when it's warm enough, that there could be some microbial life there?
Well, maybe. As you said, we think this actually came from micrometeorites that struck the surface that had water inside of them. And you know, once they heat up, they end up releasing that water into the soil. So it's a possibility, but we don't know how long this water has been there, probably not all that long. And we think that it takes, you know, quite some time for life to start to arise in the water. So I wouldn't go as far as saying that this is evidence for, you know, life on the moon or anything like that. But it's definitely exciting for us to study because when we go back to the moon, we may be able to use this as a source of water for the humans that are going to stay there. So maybe there's water in other locations that we just haven't studied in quite as much detail yet.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's Astronomy Today. Val, we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll hit the phones, 800-348-2551, if you have an astronomy question. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's Astronomy Today. We're joined today by Dr. Valerie Rapson. And if you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Speaking of the heavens, this must be one of those rare occasions, Valerie, where there's a meteor shower and it's not cloudy and raining by my house. It looks like it's going to be a clear night tonight and the torrids are about to peak.
Yeah. The next couple of days are going to be gorgeous where I am, too. So definitely, you know, get outside before it gets too cold. But you're right. Yeah, the torrids are peaking in the next couple of days. And if you go out early in the evening, you might have less of a chance of seeing the meteors, but you can get out before the moon starts to come up because, unfortunately, the moon's going to be in the way a little bit for the next week. But we're expecting, you know, at least a few tens of meteors an hour for this shower. And this one is known for fireballs. So there might be a couple of large, longer-lasting shooting stars up there in the sky for people to see.
Yeah, you know, I saw that this one in particular, this torrid meteor shower, and it goes over a long period of time, features long-lasting meteors. So we're going to send the kids out, and we'll see if we can spot a couple tonight. By the way, you know, you and I were talking via email earlier and saying, geez, I hope we didn't offend Bob Berman. And then all of a sudden, here at 2:23, Bob Berman shows up. How you doing, Bob?
Oh, yay.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thank you. Yeah, I've been waiting for the call from you guys all this time, and I finally called the station to see what's going on. So I'm not sure
what
happened.
Let me ask you a question, Bob. You're a smart guy. Do you ever check your email?
Of course I do, but, you know, there is a spam folder. I could have missed it.
Most of my emails do go to spam. Anyway, we've talked about a lot of interesting things, and we have an email here that kind of ties in with what Valerie and I were just talking about, which was the torrid meteor shower, and it looks like the weather will be fantastic, at least for the next couple of nights, to see it, although the moon is a little bright. It's waning. This is from Kate. And Kate writes, last week, I think I saw a shooting star, but it was unlike any I've seen before. It looked like a long, twinkling mass of stars traveling across the sky. It lasted quite a while, maybe a good 30 seconds, until it went behind the tops of trees and I couldn't see it anymore. Shooting stars I've seen in the past are always a little blip. They come and go really quickly. What I saw traveled slowly. Could it have been a comet? Also, it didn't have a bright mass at the front of the direction it was traveling. It was evenly twinkling throughout. I live in upstate New York. Saw it in the south, southwest. I think I have a theory, but let's throw it to Bob since he's the newcomer on today's show.
Yeah, well, that's very cool. Meteors vary, and this could have been a torrid or it could have been a sporadic. And some of them, especially the Spirax, come in at a shallow angle, and they can last a long time across the sky. They can be at any speed, depending upon whether they're hitting Earth straight on, depending on their composition. They can be different colors. Something with more mass, believe it or not, most of them are the size of an apple seed. But let's say there's something really big, which would be the size of a grape. Well, then it's going to be brilliant and cast shadows. So they really vary. And people who have watched meteors all their lives can attest that they come in all types. One of the reasons it's so much fun to watch meteors.
But based on this description, doesn't this sound more like one of those Starlink launches?
Yeah, well, that's what I was
going to
suggest.
Yeah, it could have been. And, you know, we've got so many things, hundreds of functioning satellites and thousands of satellites, including the ones that aren't functioning, that, sure, they come into the atmosphere periodically. And I don't think they necessarily even get any notice in the papers when they do. I sure don't get them, so who knows?
Yeah, let's quickly go to the phones here at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson and the newly arrived but old-timer on this program, Bob Berman. Let's go to Ed in Wilbraham. You started off, Ed.
Hello. What I'm wondering about is if we measure out from here, the edge of the universe will be about 13 or 14 billion years out. Regardless of which direction you're measuring, how is that possible that we would be in the center of the universe?
That's a great, great question. So what you're thinking of here is kind of our observable universe. The actual universe is actually quite a bit bigger than that. But we perceive that we are at the center of the universe, not because we actually are at the center of the universe, but because we can only see so far in certain directions. And the universe is expanding from every single point in space, so it's always growing larger. But since we're limited by the speed of light and how far away we see, we're always going to think we're at the center of the universe, when in reality, somebody at Andromeda or another nearby galaxy would actually conclude the same thing based on their observation. So it's really kind of a where am I observing from question, as opposed to whether or not I'm actually in the center of the universe.
And Bob, you always say that the center of the universe is in Woodstock, right?
Socrates. But I like Valerie's answer a lot. And because there's all sorts of paradoxes in this, for example, the fact that everything has been expanding since we observed the light of these distant things, yeah, we can say when the caller said 13.8 billion light years away, not really, because that's just how long the light has been traveling to us. In the meantime, while the light's been traveling, the object has been expanding all these billions of years, so that today it's probably closer to 35 billion light years away, and that would be a truer radius of the universe. But because of all these paradoxes, I always say that the best thing is not to picture the universe as a giant balloon that's expanding and that we're somewhere in that, even in the center or what have you, but just to see it the way it is, which is that, as Valerie said, everything is expanding away from everything else. So from our perspective, nearby things are moving away from us slowly, 13 miles per second for every million light years further they are. And farther objects are expanding away from us faster. And you'd see that no matter where you were. You'd see yourself at the locus of all the expansion that's going on.
Ed, thanks a lot for the question. All right, before we go to the next call, I have to ask this of both of you. If the universe is expanding, right, and I am part of the universe and you are part of the universe, why are we not also expanding at the same time?
I'll bet Valerie's going to say great question to that, right? Because why should there be segments to it? Why should things be
right.
Parts be expanding and parts not be expanding? And that actually is an excellent question.
But it turns out
that local things are not expanding because there are other things, the strong force and the weak force within atoms, gravity within small systems like a globular cluster, even our galaxy, that prevents expansion. So you end up with the local stuff, our solar system, our galaxy, even our cluster of galaxies, the local group, we call it, not expanding, holding together. In fact, in some cases, things coming toward other things, just as Dromeda is coming towards us at 70 miles a second. But then the expansion of the universe is only large scale. So we think of it as clusters of galaxies expanding away from other clusters of galaxies. And anytime you zoom in any closer than that, within the cluster, within the galaxy itself, within solar systems, no, then there's no expansion.
Valerie, why is there no expansion at close range?
Well, Bob's got it exactly right. And I want to say, first of all, I try very hard every day not to get my body to expand any more than it already is.
Yeah, after Thanksgiving, I think we all expand. You make a point. Yes.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But just as Bob said, the forces that hold things together act on different scales. So we've got that strong and the weak force that acts on the small scales that hold our atoms together. And all of that acts, you know, in the size scales of our everyday world. And then you've got gravity and you've got the expansion of the universe, which acts at such a larger scale. So we only see the expansion at great distances. We don't see the expansion on these smaller scales because the other forces hold us together.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson is here from SUNY Oneonta, and Bob Berman is here. Bob, is your new book out yet?
Yes, it is. And it's the last book with just my name on it is still the one about the cataclysms of the universe called Earth Shattering. But now I have a brand new, I think it's actually going to be out and for another month, but this is the one that I wrote with Robert Lanza, the medical doctor and
biocentrism
in what used to be called Yugoslavia. And this one's called The Grand Biocentric Design.
Okay. By the way, Valerie, I don't know, are you on a speakerphone by any chance?
I am not. No, are you having trouble hearing me?
You fade in and out a little bit, so now
I'll try and fix that.
Just now you're fine, so let's just keep rolling.
Okay.
We'll go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris.
Yeah, Valerie, I got a couple questions for you.
Sure.
Black holes, are they visible in the galaxy? And the other question is, excuse me, Valerie, I understand there's new stars in our galaxy that I heard on Stargate this past week. And the last one is, I hear that Mr. Branson is going to launch his jet to Mars sometime in the near future. I don't know how true that is.
Yeah. So we'll tackle these one at a time here. So the black holes, you can't really directly see them in a sense that when you look at a galaxy, you're not going to see a black circle or a black dot in your pictures. What you will see is a collection of stars that are orbiting around the black hole. And that bright spot signify that a black hole is actually there. So that's really what you want to look for. It's kind of counterintuitive, but you want to look for the bright spot in the galaxy as opposed to any little dark spots. Now, as you said, our galaxy is forming new stars. We have a star formation rate of about 1 to 10 new stars that form in our galaxy every single year. So we actually do have recycling of material and active star formation going on as we speak. So we can look at those young stars and try and learn something about how our star originally formed.
All right, Chris,
and
thanks.
Then your last one was Mars here, right? Maybe, I don't know, does Bob want to make a comment about Mars? He always has an opinion about going to Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know about going to Mars, but everybody who has a telescope, you've only got about another week or two left, and then it won't be this good again until the year 2035. So really grab that chance. Easy to find. It's that brightest orange star in the whole sky, and it's out all night long. So easy to find, and if you have a decent backyard telescope, it's still about 20 arc seconds across, which is just marginally large enough to show detail. There's a tiny little southern polar cap. There's dark surface markings. It's very cool on nights that are steady, meaning the stars are not twinkling. And if you have a backyard telescope that's just gathering dust, this is the time to use it.
Beautiful. It's just fun to look at with the naked eye. It's stunning out there in the sky. By the way, we have an email here from Matt in Prescott, Arizona. He must know one of you. And this is for Valerie and Bob. Matt writes, Given the demotion of Pluto to a minor planet and the current emphasis on campaigns, I'd like to propose a campaign of our own. What if future discoveries confirm that Pluto should really be considered a full-fledged planet? Would we then reinstate Pluto to its original glory and prestigious position in our solar system? I think we would, but what if the discoverer of a planet named his discovery a really cool name, but then other individuals not part of the discovery trumped him, pun intended, and named it something else? I propose the order of planets in our solar system should be Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, George, and finally Neptune. Yes, I propose we start a campaign to return the planet Uranus back to its former glorious name of George, with all due respect, and that is from Matt. Which one of you knows Matt?
I know Matt. Matt's a good buddy of mine.
Okay,
yes, he's also the director of Prescott Observatory.
See, I had a feeling. I just had a feeling. Well, hello to our friends in Prescott, Arizona.
Yeah. And you know why Valerie and I both laughed? Because when he wrote George, we both remember that when it was first discovered, the discoverer, William Herschel, this was in 1781, wanted to butter up the King George, and originally decided to name it George. Of course, more rational minds prevailed, and the tradition of naming planets after Roman gods prevailed finally, but that's why that's such a funny comment. The problem with Pluto is that if we were going to go back into it, nobody has a stomach for re-raising this issue of whether it's a planet or not. It's just, it proves a lot of bad feelings to even get into that food fight again. But the common consensus now, other than sentimentality and that whole goofy dog business and all the rest of the associations with it, is that it was misclassified when it was discovered.
Yeah.
If we had only known back in 1930 that it was as tiny as it is, smaller than our moon, along with other eccentricities, or if we had only known that there were other objects as large as it or larger in that vicinity, we would have come up with something better. But as it stands, if we were to reinstate it, you've got other objects like Sedna and Eris and Quarwar and Makemake and others that would also have to be planets because they're just as big and they're in the same vicinity. And you'd have lots and lots and lots and lots of new planets, all of them very dissimilar to the other eight planets. So it just doesn't seem like the thing to do.
Fair enough. Let's take a quick call here before our next break. 800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question for Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Jerry is in Lanesboro. Jerry, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I are interested in getting a telescope, but we're not quite sure where to start. I was hoping I could get a little bit of guidance.
Yes, you started up the typical feud that Bob and I have when we give telescope advice here.
Yeah.
I always suggest more smaller Dobsonian style. These are telescopes that are easy to move around. They have like a squarish wooden base. You only really need about a 6 or 8 inch telescope to really get started and see some amazing things. But I know Bob likes to suggest the more tripod telescopes and a little bit bigger computerized ones. But we can definitely, if you shoot us an email, we can definitely send both of our suggestions.
Well,
you know, and it's true. And the issue is this: we've both seen, I'm sure, lots of people who buy a telescope and then it doesn't get used. It sits in an attic or gathers dust, and someone uses it the first time and then never again. So, or you start to use it and you immediately want a larger one, the way people are with boats. Those of us who have friends with boats know what that's like. You know, you want a bigger one. So how do you stop this process of having it either not used or wanting a bigger one right away? I agree with Valerie in that I think we should first find out if the person who wants it has a serious and ongoing interest in astronomy, or if this is just something that popped into their head and they want a quick look or two. And if there's any doubt, I think go with what Valerie's saying, a Dobsonian, 6-inch, 8-inch. That'll show you plenty of stuff. And the only downside is that it doesn't have a motor, usually, that'll track the stars. So when you look at something within a minute or two, Earth's rotation will make it go out of the field of view. So maybe then you'll start thinking, well, I'd rather have one with a clock drive that follows the stars.
But they're very expensive.
Yeah, once you start going that route and get something that'll truly give you a lifetime of satisfaction, and especially if you don't want to collimate it or hassle with that, these days there are amazing refractors in the 4 and even 5 inch size, but they're thousands of dollars. And probably the caller doesn't have that in mind.
No.
So you know what? I'm coming around to Valerie. I think she's probably right. Go for that Dobsonian. These are simple telescopes. They're sort of like lazy Susans. They just swivel around. They go up and down. They're easy to point. Use that for a while, a year or two. And then if you want some improvement in that, then go from there. But, yeah, I think she's right. Start with that.
All right.
Hey, finally persuaded you.
Valerie Rapson is with us at Bob Berman. It's Astronomy. Give us a shout if you have a question about the heavens. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman and Rich, who is in Schenectady. Rich.
Yeah, hi. I think I may have an explanation for that. The woman that called in with that twinkling object that she saw for some time.
It was an email.
I experienced something like that 2 or 3 years ago. Now, I'm a pilot, a weather observer professionally, and I also astronomy for like 65 years or so.
Yep.
I'm very familiar with meteors and stuff like that. I was up north camping at the person's house, looking up, lying in a cot on a bed, through a skylight, and looked up in a pitch black Adirondack sky, a thing slowly moving across, just like a sparkler, just like on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
But it's moving very, very extremely slow and actually giving off sparkles like that. I says, what in the dickens is that?
Yeah.
But anyways, it lasted for quite a while, like 10 or 12 seconds like that in the amount of time it was. So I looked up my aeronautical chart, a sectional chart that all pilots use, and sure enough, there was a military training route. I think it was Route 724 that goes across the Adirondacks, went right precisely almost over their house. So I would now I'm thinking, why would be sparklers like that on an aircraft, a military aircraft? They do have fighter aircraft like A-10 Warthogs will drop
flares
to disengage or to break the lock on surface-to-air missiles by deflecting them, you know, towards the thing. But it was nothing like that. It was not apparently dropped from an aircraft. It was moving along with the aircraft. So I'm just remiss in not calling Barnes or wherever these things came out of to say, what the heck was that thing you got on your airplanes?
And what did you call them?
I never did.
Because you'd be on a list right now. I bet you they'd be saying, okay, who's this guy and why does he want to know? All right, man. Hey, well, thanks a lot for that one. We appreciate the call. Have you ever seen anything else strange up there while you were up there?
No, not at all.
No? Bob's been a pilot, too. He's never seen a UFO. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, with 21, I don't know if I'm going to impress this pilot, but with 2,100 hours, all VFR, by the way, and a lot of night flying in our area, all these years, 30 years or so, I've never seen what I'd call a UFO.
The number here, by the way, is 800-348-2551, and it is Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. I'll tell you both, though, this really has nothing to do with astronomy, but I highly recommend you watch a new documentary that is on, Amazon or whatever, wherever you get your videos. It's called The Phenomenon. Watch it, Bob. You're a pilot, and there are a lot of these Air Force pilots who will say, I saw a couple weird things. It's a great documentary.
Okay. I still have an open mind.
Yeah, I think you'll find it to be fascinating. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question today. And Bob, give us a quick, before we get to our next call, and we'll jump right back on the phones here in a minute, give us a quick précis on your new book.
Oh, thank you for that. Well, this is the third in the biocentrism books, and this is Robert Lanza's idea. He had fame for his cloning. He was the first one. He made all the headlines for cloning of animals and parts of humans some years back, and we both have the same agent as Stephen Hawking, by the way. And some years back, good 10, 12, 15, my agent said, well, this other guy wants to write a book about this idea, but it's just kind of not really clear. Can you help? So that's how I got involved and wound up writing the whole thing. And essentially, biocentrism, just to make it quick, is an ancient idea. I mean, Buddhism and Hinduism and a lot of the thoughts of the ancient Greeks said the same thing, which is that life or consciousness or our own awareness are part and parcel of nature. We're not observers that are outside of nature. Our very observation and consciousness determines what's around us. And since the quantum originators a century ago, Niels Bohr and Heisenberg and all the others, were going down that same alley, it really has a scientific basis, and we just flesh that out and make it more scientific.
Interesting. Now, you have attempted to make it scientific, but ultimately, is this a falsifiable or provable thing, or is this based primarily on faith akin to religion?
Thank you. Thank you. And it's a great question. And in the first two books, which had Deepak Chopra's glowing commentary on the cover, that didn't do much to help us convince people that it wasn't philosophy or even metaphysics. Mm. But this one has many chapters, including equations and much more hard science and physics. So I think this is going to convince people who are really into the pure science that it's valid, including we do an amazing thing and show how finally quantum mechanics and Einstein's relativity can be merged, can be synthesized for the first time if observers are taken into the picture.
Valerie Rapson, you got your PhD at RIT in astrophysical sciences and technology. Were you ever offered a course on something like that?
No, but it sounds fascinating, and I'm definitely going to have to get a copy of Bob's book and read it, because I know he's talked before about this idea of consciousness, and we've had a lot of callers chatting about it. But I really honestly don't know very much about the theory, so I'm really excited to learn more, and it sounds like it definitely warrants a college class for sure, even if it's more like of a debate class where we just discuss things as opposed to really hardcore science. So,
well, there you go,
fascinating,
Bob.
For sure.
There's one sale. You're that much closer to your next telescope. This one is from
there you go.
Edward in Albany. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, when we say that, you know, that everything is like 100 million years away, how do we know that the thing is still there if it took 100 million years they'd like to get here?
Okay, you got to turn your radio down just a little bit, Edward, but I think that our experts got that one. Bob, do you want to field that one?
Yeah, sure, and he's right. It does vary, because in the time it took the light to get here, anything could have happened to that object. That's why a lot of people say, well, how do we know the stars are even there? Oh, probably all the stars in the night sky aren't even there, because they could have exploded or gone away while their light was en route to us. And even though that's wrong, I love it when people say that, because they correctly have the correct idea that when we look up, we're looking into the past, and that things could have changed, and we're not seeing how things are, but how they were. The reason it's wrong is because stars live for billions of years, and their typical distance is a couple of hundred light years. So what are the chances that even one of them isn't around anymore, considering how long they live? It's very small. So probably all the stars in the night sky are still there. But the caller is right that anything we see, star could have gone into a supernova and not even been there, and yet we're still seeing its light from that left it before that happened.
Edward, thank you very much for the call. 800-348-2551. If you want to get a question in here for Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman, it's Astronomy Today. 800-348-2551. Valerie, how long would it be if the sun exploded before we here on Earth would know that it happened?
So we would lose the light after about 8 minutes. That's how long it takes the light to get from the sun to Earth. So we'd see the sun shining, and then as soon as it goes dark, it technically would have disappeared, went dark, whatever, 8 minutes ago.
That's right. And listen to this. The light that hits the moon, depending upon where it is in its orbit, but when it's a crescent moon, the moon is a little closer to the sun, to us, than the sun is. It's always closer to us than the sun is. But if the sun has already set, so you can't see that the sun has blown up because it's set, but there's a crescent moon, and suddenly it goes out. You have a head start on everyone else. Grab the phone and sell your stocks.
We were looking at a very bright full moon. I don't know if it was Halloween or the one before that. And my wife was just amazed at how bright the moon was this particular night. And she said, do the astronauts have to wear sunglasses? And, you know, for a minute, it took me a while to think back to those moon landings. But they had sunglasses on their visors, didn't they?
They did. People get this wrong. Like, if I were to ask you, Ray, even though you always impress people like my wife with how knowledgeable you are, nonetheless, I'll bet you get this wrong.
Yeah.
How much dimmer do you think moonlight is, let's say the full moon, than sunlight? Or put another way, when you look at a moonlit scene in the countryside, how the full moon is bathing the surroundings with light compared to a sunlit scene, how many times dimmer do you think it is, if you had a guess?
I could not possibly guess, but and I don't even know how you would figure that out. I guess it's based on what the distance from the sun to the moon and
no,
then...
No, don't figure it out. Just like with a photometer or with a camera, you know, a camera photometer.
I would say 1/6.
1/6. The answer is full moonlight is 450,000 times fainter than sunlight.
You are kidding me.
No.
I mean, it was bright. It was casting shadows.
I know. Everyone is always surprised at that. 450,000 times dimmer.
But when you're on the moon, you need protection from that sun all the time, right?
Well, yeah, sure. The lack of the atmosphere, too, makes the in-between lighting non-existent. So everything on the moon is very stark. It's either sunlit or it's pitch black in shadow with no in-between.
Now I'll circle back to something Valerie and I were discussing at the very beginning of the show. And
this before is, you called me to have me come in.
You know what, Bob? You got to check your email. We take no blame at all on this, all right? Just so you know, just so we're clear about this. This was a press release from NASA that Valerie sent our way. NASA's SOFIA discovers water on sunlit surface of moon. And we got into a discussion about what SOFIA is, and it's a very cool project. But the fact that there could be water on the moon. Now, we know in the bottom of craters that are out of the sun, yes. But this is a different situation. And my question was, and I think we were going to break, and I didn't get a follow-up. Why is it that the water would stay there and not just evaporate? Assuming the temperature gets high enough, which, Valerie, you said it would at times, why wouldn't it just evaporate into space? There's no atmosphere.
It doesn't make sense to me. We've spoken in the past about how ice cannot melt on the moon because you can't have liquid unless the ice or the water is under pressure and there's no atmospheric pressure on the moon. So it can't melt. There's no liquid, but it turns right from ice into vapor. We actually see that on Earth called sublimation. If you see a pile of snow, let's say snow plows have cleaned out a parking lot and made piles of snow, sometimes on a sunny day we see what looks like smoke or steam rising from that pile of snow, and that's sublimation. That's the ice turning directly into vapor. So on the moon, that's what would happen. But Ray, I have no idea why that should not happen in the sunlit regions, which is why the Army's Clementine spacecraft, which originally found ice, as you correctly said, in permanently shadowed craters near the lunar poles, well, that's fine because that's always over 200 degrees below zero. But in the sunlit sections, doesn't make sense to me, but I didn't see the news story, so I don't know.
What's your theory, Valerie?
Yeah, I think it has to do with the fact that the water's not necessarily sitting right on the top of the surface of the moon, and it's kind of mixed in with the soil, so you've got some chemical reactions that might inhibit it, and you're not necessarily getting all that direct sunlight on the water to sublimate it. And again, we think that this water is probably constantly refreshed. It's not micrometeorites that hit the moon and left the water a billion years ago. It's ones that are actively striking the moon today that are leaving behind the water. So it's possible that this is very freshly deposited material on the moon as opposed to something that's been there a while. So that could kind of be what we're seeing.
Boy, I like that answer. You know, people sometimes ask me, how do you know so much on the shows? And I tell them, honestly, I said, I just make it up. But I've never really heard
you don't say that
on making
air.
It up before until just now. And it was a great job. Because that really makes sense.
Well, one of the people at the Goddard Space Flight Center said this: without a thick atmosphere, water on the sunlit lunar surface should be lost to space. Yet, somehow we're seeing it. Something is generating the water, and something must be trapping it there. I think this is an interesting mystery.
Yeah, it is.
Several forces could be at play in the delivery or creation of water. Micrometeorites, as Valerie said, carrying small amounts of water. Another possibility is a two-step process whereby the sun's solar wind delivers hydrogen to the surface of the moon and causes a chemical reaction with oxygen-bearing minerals. Well, I have not.
That makes sense because the moon is mostly oxygen. The surface of the moon is more than 50% oxygen. So what you just said makes sense.
The moon.
Right.
Go ahead, Valerie.
Oh, I was just going to say that you're right. You can make those hydroxyl molecules, the O and the H, and then if you add another hydrogen, you've got your water. So the chemical reaction can happen with that solar wind.
Now, is the Earth a similar composition, up to half oxygen?
Oh, yeah. In fact, our bodies also. And that's why I wrote in one of my books that when you have wolves howling at the moon, essentially it's oxygen howling at oxygen.
Did you write that in one of your books, Bob?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I didn't read that paragraph. That's interesting. All right, Valerie, you guys are wrapping up fairly soon at SUNY Oneonta before Thanksgiving break?
Yes, we are. So we'll actually continue a little bit after Thanksgiving break, but we've got the end of the semester coming, and then looking forward to spring. Lots of great classes to teach in the springtime, too.
How excited would you be if the COVID finally leaves us and come spring, you could take the kids out and look at the stars?
Oh, gosh, I would be ecstatic. I am missing that so much. We didn't have the opportunity to see the observatory. We only got in the planetarium once before things got crazy. So I'm just really missing giving those students that amazing experience of playing with the telescopes and experiencing nights under the stars.
Valerie Rapson, thanks for being here, and good luck wrapping up the season. We will talk to you soon, and we'll make sure we call you and email you as well.
Sounds good.
All right, Bob Berman, you don't have a firm launch time or date for your book yet.
I think it's next month. I think that's the release date. I just got a box of them in the mail, so I know they're printed. So
all right.
we'll see what happens.
All right, make sure you ship Valerie a copy. And, sir,
you know what? I'll bring in a copy for both of you guys.
All right, you got to sign it, though. And listen, check your email, will you? Come on, man.
All right, okay.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. Support comes from the Hyde Collection, featuring two new exhibits: J.S. Woolley, photographer, and Images of the People, Russian lacquer painting, by appointment only, hydecollection.org. At Capital Roots, providing essential food services to seniors, families, and vulnerable populations during these challenging times, while also supporting our small farms and local businesses. CapitalRoots.org to learn more. Well, we're out of time. Thanks again to Dr. Valerie Rapson and the one and only Bob Berman for being here today. Thank you for calling. Thank you for listening. Thank you for emailing. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Our producer, Jackie Orchard. Phones answered by Matt Plummer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, another exciting week comes to a close, and we will do a week in review with Judy Patrick. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.